You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. Continuing our month of shows about the crossover between comics and video games, I'm talking to American cartoonist Gene Luen Yang about his recent comics on the subject, including his graphic novel Level Up and web strip Legends of the Joystick, both illustrated in watercolours by Tien Pham. I'm also talking to Gene about the use of autobiography in his comics, the elegant simplicity of older video games, and the occurrences of magical realism in his work, from American-born Chinese to his forthcoming graphic novels about the Boxer Rebellion. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
You teach computer science, and your father was an electrical engineer. So your writing a graphic novel about computer games almost has a certain level of inevitability about it.
Yeah, that might be true. That might be true. Although I personally am not very good at video games at all.
Okay.
You know, especially ever since they went 3D. You know, now when I play modern games, they just make me feel parsick.
Mm.
But computers and technology have definitely been a part of my family history.
Mm. No, I completely agree with you on 3D games. I feel that they don't somehow have the charm of older games with the side-scrolling and the pixels. And I don't know if that's because, I mean, people talk about this thing called the uncanny valley, where 3D graphics try to become more naturalistic, but they actually level out at some kind of plateau, which is actually both realistic and unnatural at the same time, and that's what creeps people out.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The trailer for the new Tintin movie? They're definitely playing close to that uncanny valley.
Yeah. But your book, Level Up, is definitely an homage to those pixelated games of the 1980s, things like Pac-Man and Mario Brothers. Presumably you had some exposure and interest in them as a kid.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was just part of popular culture when I was growing up. You know, I'm in my mid-30s now, and most people around my age grew up with Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and Qbert as part of our daily lives. So, you know, as we were coming of age, so was the video game industry. I think the very first wave of popular games came about when we were maybe in junior high or high school.
Although Level Up isn't an autobiography like elements of American-born Chinese were, it does have a ring of autobiography to it, so I was wondering how much of it was based on your own experiences in high school and college, and how much of it was other characters that you met in real life.
Well, the story itself was actually inspired by my brother. I have a younger brother who's 4 years younger than me, and he's a medical doctor now, so he's the good Asian son. And when he was going through med school, he would come home and he would tell me all these crazy stories about his class assignments. I don't know if you have any doctors in your family or among your friends, but it's really gross to become a doctor. You have to do a lot of really, really disgusting things. So he would come home and he'd tell me all of these disgusting things. And as I was listening to his stories, I knew that I wanted to put them in some kind of comic book. Mm. The problem was that his stories were all just a collection of interesting incidents. There was never any sort of dramatic center that tied everything together. But then one day he calls me up and he tells me that he's thinking about specializing in gastroenterology, which is the specialization of the digestive tract.
Mm.
Right? And it's all of it. It's both the upper and the lower digestive tract. And when he told me that, I was shocked because growing up, my brother was a pretty squeamish guy. We used to have these toys that were this weird yellow brownish color, and he eventually had to give those toys away because it reminded him of vomit. You know, he's just a really, really squeamish guy. So I said to him, you know, you're so squeamish, I don't understand why you would choose to do gastroenterology, because since the focus is on the digestive tract, you're just going to be dealing with human fecal matter all day. That's like going to be your whole career. And he tells me, well, the other day I did a colonoscopy, and it's basically like playing video games of somebody's rear. So when he told me that, it sort of tied together, you know, our childhood love of video games with this immigrants' parents' pressure. You know, a lot of immigrants' parents put pressure on their kids to become either doctors or lawyers or engineers. So since it tied these two things together, I felt like it would make a good center to that story. After I started writing the story, I think I started drawing more and more from my own relationship with my dad. So it started with my brother, but I think the story ended with my dad. My dad came to the United States in the late 60s, early 70s, and like a lot of the immigrants that came during that era, he was very practical-minded. When we were growing up, he always talked to us about making very practical choices with our careers, you know, and he basically presented us with that Chinese trinity, that choice of either a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. As I was writing this book, I was thinking about my relationship with him, and I was thinking about how, as I get older and older, I find that I'm agreeing with him more and more. You know, when I was little, we would always have this fight. My dad and I would always have this fight where I would want to draw cartoons, and she would want me to do that practical thing, to make those practical choices. But now, as I'm older, I don't regret at all my choice of drawing cartoons. But I find that a lot of his concerns that were beneath the suggestion to choose doctor, lawyer, and engineer are things that I want to take into account as I go through my career. You know, I want to make sure that I have a regular income, and I want to make sure that my family has health insurance, and I want to make sure that I'm doing something meaningful with my life. So I find that as I get older, I want to integrate the desires of my heart and the concerns of my parents more and more.
Well, they always say that you eventually grow up to turn into your parents, so I think it's something that a lot of people can associate with.
Isn't that scary? Like, I sometimes I look at myself in the mirror, And I'm starting to see more and more of my dad. It's just, I guess it's an inevitable part of life.
The combination of reality and fantasy, which in your book is a combination of these four angels that the lead character sees, and also the depiction of, like, his pixelated lives evaporating each time a major decision happens in his life. That sort of magical realism is something that seems to have occurred throughout your works. And in this book in particular, thinking of that magical realism combined with the idea of the heroic doctor made me think of Osama Tezuka's work to a certain extent. I was wondering if you were a fan of his in particular.
I am. You know, Tezuka is one of the reasons I started reading manga. When I was in high school, I was very anti-Japanese comics. One of my best friends at the time was a huge manga fan, and I was very much into American superhero comics. We would have all these arguments about which culture produced better comics, you know? And he would talk about how American comics were all adolescent male power fantasies, and I would talk about how the Japanese drew these ridiculous faces where the eyes were like half of the character's head, and I couldn't understand how you could relate to them. Well, in college, I read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics. You know that book?
Yeah.
It's an amazing book, and I think, I don't know if I would be drawing comics right now if I hadn't read that book. In any case, in that, he talks a lot about the Japanese style of storytelling, you know, and that got me intrigued, and I figured I would just start with the best. I would start with Osamu Tezuka, the god of manga. The first book I read of his was Adolf. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah.
It's an amazing book, right? Amazing book about, set in World War II, about basically about Hitler's hidden Jewish birth certificate, which I think is fiction, but it's an amazing book, and it totally blew my mind. I I uh, I was just shocked at how compelling these characters with these giant eyes were. You know, they were, even though American comics, at least American comics in the 70s and 80s are drawn in a more realistic style, even though they were drawn in a more realistic style than these Tezuka drawings, I definitely felt a deeper emotional connection with Tezuka's characters than I ever had with American superheroes. So I can't say that I'm a huge manga reader right now, but I definitely read a lot of Tezuka, and I also like this other guy named Naoki Urasawa, who did a series called Monster. He did Monster, and he did 20th Century Boys. Yeah, amazing artist, amazing storyteller.
I suppose it was just the idea of the heroic doctor who's larger than life that made me think of Tezuka in particular. But
Blackjack
and various...
I think there's a reason why there's so many doctor dramas on TV. There's just something very compelling about that profession, and there's also something very visual about it as well.
In Level Up, though, there are obviously loads of other influences, and the angels in particular. I was wondering what gave you the initial idea that the lead character should have four angels surrounding him in his life. I mean, eventually they're revealed to be Blinky, Pinky, Inky, and Clyde, if I know my Pac-Man. But was it...
Although we can't say that, right? That's a copyright violation.
Well, I think
yes, that's true.
We can say it on radio, but you can't say it in the book.
You know, version of the book that's out now is actually the second version that we did.
Okay.
Kid and I did a version of the book called Three Angels, where there were only three angels.
Okay.
And we were almost done with it. You know, it was maybe 120 pages, and we were maybe 5 pages away from finishing, when my editor calls me up and says, you know, the story just isn't working. Now, and he basically asked us to start over. At the time, I think we were at the very least disappointed, maybe even a little mad. But now looking back, I think he was totally right. In that original version, the Pac-Man connection wasn't there, and it was just a much stiffer version of the story. So I had started writing that right after American Born Chinese was published, and after American Born Chinese started getting all that attention, I freaked out a little bit because I realized up until then I'd been always composing my stories based purely on my gut, on instinct. And I felt like I didn't really know anything about story structure or plot or building character or anything. So I read all of these books, you know, any book I could find in the library about writing and about composing fiction, I read. So the first version of Level Up, Three Angels, was actually constructed based on all of that advice that I had gathered from all these different books. So I just think that as a result, it came out very, very stiff. And it just didn't have a lot of part to it. So in the second version, that's when we decided to expand the three angels into four and connect them to, you know, the four ghosts from Pac-Man. I think it actually ends up working a lot better. That's why there are four. It's because there are four ghosts in the original Pac-Man game.
It made me think of, in American Born Chinese, that the highest power in the Monkey God universe is, again, a pantheon of four gods, if I remember it correctly.
Is it? I thought it was eight. I could
possibly
be wrong, too, though.
I'm flicking through the book now, trying to find a visual reference.
Oh, you mean for my book?
Yes.
My book?
Yeah.
Yeah, in my book it is. In my book it is. That's right.
So there's...
But in the original, yeah, I think it's eight gods. My version of the Monkey King definitely deviates from the original in significant ways. I tried to westernize it a bit.
But it does suggest, though, that to a certain extent you're obsessed with the number four.
It could be true. You know, four in Chinese numerology is actually a very bad number, because it's a homonym. In Chinese, it's a homonym for death.
Oh, gosh.
So I don't know what that means. Maybe I should start dressing in all black.
What led you to choose Tian Pham as the artist of Level Up? Because, I mean, I think his art is terrific in the book, but it surprises me that you didn't draw it yourself, because in a way... your more cartoony style would almost seem to suit a graphic novel about computer games more than an artist who has more of a watercolor illustrative edge to him.
Yeah. He's a good friend of mine. He's a Bay Area cartoonist. He's also a teacher. He teaches at the same school that I teach at. each other all the time. He's one of my best friends.
Hmm.
So I think the decision really came out of our friendship. I remember him showing me some of the pages from an upcoming project of his called Sumo, and I was really impressed with them. So I just thought it might be fun to work with him. And another reason I didn't draw it myself is because I'm working on another project that I'm both writing and drawing. And drawing is just so labor-intensive and so time-consuming that it's very difficult to work on two projects at once.
Sure.
If you're handling both the writing and the art. And he actually chose watercolor for the second version. The first version of the book that we did wasn't in watercolor. He had been planning on coloring it with computer, mm-hmm. the way most comics are colored now. In the second version, he chose to do watercolor, I think, as a way of offsetting that stiffness that he saw in the first version.
Mm.
You know, watercolor is a very unpredictable medium. You know, you don't really have complete control of it ever.
Mm.
And he thought that having that lack of control could offset some of the stiffness that he saw in the script.
Well, and also the reproduction in the graphic novel by First Second, it's really nice how you can still see the texture of the watercolor page underneath the artwork.
Yeah, watercolor is notoriously hard to reproduce on the printed page, and First Second definitely did an amazing job. But even so, if you look at Tim's originals, they're still much more brilliant than what you can even see on that page, on that printed page.
But also, I mean, that aspect of seeing the watercolor page, and also in a few occasions, some pencil lines that he's obviously used as well.
Yeah.
Are really evocative of the idea of the lead character's sort of jottings and like sketching a joypad into a table and so on. And I think it works really well with the subject matter.
Yeah, that's true. There is that theme of control in that runs through the story. And the fact that he uses an uncontrolled medium is a nice juxtaposition.
The overall package, I don't know if we can say what the book itself looks like, but making the graphic novel look like an iconic piece of video game technology, was that something you'd intended from the outset? Because it obviously is a very nice object as well.
Yeah, Tin and I talked about it. Tin is primarily a mini comic guy.
Mm.
So I don't know. I'm sure you're familiar with the mini comics culture, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you write and draw a comic and then you publish it yourself. So when Tim publishes his own mini-comics, he probably spends more time on the packaging of a book than he does on the book itself. You know, he creates these beautiful silkscreen covers. Sometimes they have these elaborate folding patterns. He uses Japanese stitch binding sometimes. So they're beautifully packaged. So when I decided to work with Tim, I knew that was going to be a thing for this project, that he would spend a lot of time thinking about the packaging of this book. So I don't remember who came up with the Game Boy idea. It was in a conversation that we had.
Mm.
But he definitely took it all the way to the end and made it look amazing. We also had a lot of input from Colleen Venable, who's a designer at First Second. She's the one that came up with the idea of using the tape at the back of the book, you know, to showcase some of my other books.
Okay.
Because anybody who's ever owned one of those Nintendo Game Boys knows that battery cover always breaks off, and you always have to use masking tape to tape it up. So she added that element to it.
Nice. When it comes to writing a script for another artist rather than drawing it yourself, how much detail do you put into your scripts? For example, the green shade of the early pictures that represent sort of Game Boy graphics, and the rounded edges of the opening panel borders that make it look like an old-fashioned TV. Were those things that you put in the script, or were those things that were a collaborative part of the collaborative process?
I wrote the script as thumbnails. So
okay.
What I handed to Tin was like little sketches of what each page looks like with the dialogue in a separate document. So a lot of the stuff I had put in the script. I didn't put in any of the color choices and any of that sort of thing. That was all Tim.
Mm.
But in terms of a lot of the layouts and that sort of thing, I had in the script itself.
And then a parallel project that you did at the same time as Level Up is Legends of the Joystick for Tor.com. which is obviously a much more tongue-in-cheek idea of the extracurricular activities of retired computer game characters. Was presumably that was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Tor.com, Tor is actually like a sister imprint of First Second, which published Level Up.
Okay.
Both of those imprints are under Macmillan.
Mm.
And they've recently been doing a lot of work together. So Tor.com has this whole comic section, and when Level Up was scheduled to be published, they actually contacted First Second and asked if we would be willing to do something for their comic section.
Mm.
So we, of course, said yes, because Tor.com is awesome. And we came up with that concept of doing a Where Are They Now with those old, iconic 80s video game characters. That was a lot of fun to do, partially because we love those characters, and partially because Where Are They Now type media is always fun to do.
Mm. And there's something slightly tragic about the likes of Q Burt rented in watercolours that makes it actually a lot more nostalgic than if it was more traditional computer game type graphics.
Yeah, I think I agree. You know, watercolour is associated with an older style of art, so it makes Q Burt look a lot more worn than you would if you were in bright pixels.
And even, you know, having the bats and the ball of Pong rendered as anthropomorphic characters, I thought was hilarious. But obviously you wanted to go as far back as you possibly could.
I think Tim did a great job with that.
Obviously, your graphic novel, this strip, and something like Scott Pilgrim are comics that address the nostalgic quality that computer games have for our generation. Do you think that it's a type of storytelling that is only now actually being tapped into in any sort of serious way?
I think so. I mean, I think when we were growing up, video games were still in their infancy, you know? Most video games were created by maybe one or two people, and nowadays they're created by these giant teams of people with millions and millions of dollars behind them. So I think just as a person can be nostalgic about his own childhood or her own childhood, I think as a generation we're very nostalgic about the childhood of this medium that meant so much to us when we were little.
Mm.
I actually think that part of it is also this bleeding between media that we're seeing. You know, nowadays we see a lot of adaptations from one medium to the next, and we also see works that sort of ride the border between two media.
Mm.
You know, we'll find books that are sort of half prose and maybe half comics. We'll find, you know, they're video games that are half of a traditional video game with half of a movie. Mm. You know, so I just think that technology has allowed us to do that more and more and more.
Yeah. No, I mean, I completely agree. I find a lot of PlayStation 3 games, for example, too much like movies, that actually I find it distracting, the idea that they want you to feel that you're playing a movie rather than the fact that you're playing a game.
Yeah, all those crazy camera angles, it's hard to keep track of.
But then conversely, while I don't think there's been a single good movie that's based on a computer game, something like the Scott Pilgrim movie actually felt like it was genuinely influenced by computer games, not just trying to transfer the experience of Tomb Raider into a leading actress jumping about on screen.
Yeah, that's true. I thought the Scott Pilgrim movie was very, very impressive. Some really creative things with that.
And that's why I suppose something like your graphic novel, because the influence comes from older computer games and older video games, where perhaps there would only be a single screen or a single level that was maybe the width of three or four screens being the inspiration for it, that's the sort of level design that can be transferred to the page rather than a sort of fully immersive world where you're only ever going to see snippets at any one time.
I think there's a lot of truth to that too. I also think that maybe it comes from a different place within the creator. You know, I wonder if a lot of what was driving the critical success of Scott Pilgrim, at least, was just the deep love that Brian Lee O'Malley, the creator of Scott Pilgrim, had for those 80s video games, you know, and that deep love and that passion that's very difficult to manufacture showed up on the screen, just like it did on his original pages.
Mm. And have you had any feedback on both Level Up and Legends of the Joystick of both people from our generation and also younger people who are getting into retro games for the first time?
Yeah. Some of our students, Tim and I, some of our students have come up and talked to us about it, and they said that they really like the book. You never know if they're students, though. They could just be kissing up to get a better grade. But we have gotten some feedback there. We've got some emails from people who are a little bit younger. I kind of think that this younger generation thinks of these video game icons the way maybe our generation thought of comic book icons that came before us or movie icons that came before us. You know, like most of us, when we were reading comic strips, Charles Schulz was probably past his prime, and Jack Kirby was towards the end of his career. But we still have this deep reverence for them because we love the media that they worked in.
Mm.
So I think that maybe today's video game players think the same way about Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and Q-Bert.
Mm, definitely. Well, I've just been reading Grant Morrison's book about superheroes, where it's a reverent take on superheroes from the 1930s to the present day. And it's obvious that when he was growing up in 1960 Scotland, he was reading old Spider-Man by Ditko and Fantastic Four by Kirby. And I don't have the same affection for those as I do for, say, I don't know, John Byrne during Alpha Flight in the 80s.
Yeah.
So every generation has its own kind of nostalgic reverence for the pop culture of, you know, of their time.
Yeah, that's true.
So now that you've dealt with computer games in Level Up and the Monkey God in American-born Chinese, are there any other pop culture icons that we should look forward to autobiographizing, if that's a word, in future projects?
Well, I have a couple of projects that I'm working on. One is a superhero project. It's actually an Asian American superhero project that in the 1930s and 40s.
Oh, cool.
And I'm working on that with an artist named Sunny Liu.
Mm-hmm.
He did a book called Malenki Robot, which is amazing. And then I'm also doing this book that I'm working on my own, that I'm handling all the writing and drawing myself. It's a historical fiction piece set at the time of the Boxer Rebellion. Are you familiar with the Boxer Rebellion?
Through Buffy. That's not a tragic thing to admit.
Everybody says that. Buffy did an amazing job educating people on history. So the Boxer Rebellion, basically this war that happened in China in the 1900s. Mm. In the year 1900, exactly.
Okay.
And at the time, the Chinese government was very, very weak. So all of these European powers went and established what were called concessions on Chinese land. They basically took little pieces of China's land and called it their own. So these poor, uneducated young men in the countryside, like, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old young men, they wanted to do something about it. And what they did was they came up with this ritual, you know, and they believed that when they performed this ritual, they would be possessed by characters from their own popular culture.
Huh.
So the popular culture in the countryside at the time were basically these traveling operas. You know, that was their version of TV, and these operas would play out stories about ancient heroes and gods and that sort of thing. So they believe when they perform this ritual, they'd be possessed by their pop culture icons, and they would take on the powers of their pop culture icons.
Hmm.
And then with this power, they ran through the countryside, killing off Europeans and Chinese Christians and missionaries and that sort of thing. So the whole thing was both fascinating and incredibly tragic. At the very end, these boxers, you know, these young men, they got all the way to the capital city, and at that point they were defeated by the European forces.
Hmm.
But you know, I started looking into the Boxer Rebellion maybe 5 or 10 years ago, and I found it really, really compelling, very compelling, in a tragic way.
Mm.
So I'm doing a project on this. It'll be 2 volumes. The first volume will have the boxers as the main characters, as the protagonists. And the second volume will have the Chinese Christians that they kill as the completed the first volume, and I'm starting to work on the second.
Cool. Well, it sounds fascinating. I look forward to seeing it in print.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Cool.
For more information about Gene Yang's comics, please go to his website, www.geneyang.com. That's GeneYang.com. And to read the webcomic Legends of the Joystick by Gene and Tian Pham, please go to tinyurl.com/joystickcomic. If you're listening to today's show in the UK, you can't help but have noticed that we're not having a particularly exciting summer weather-wise. However, to make up for that, to help people work on their nightclub tans, there are a variety of exciting comic book events taking place over the next few weeks. In Manchester, at the Lasso Gurry pub in Charles Street, M17DB, there are various talks being given by comic book creators, including John Repian, Al Ewing, and Brian Talbot on the 19th, 22nd and 23rd of July respectively. You can find out more about these events at manchestercomicscollective.com. That's comics spelt with an X. And tickets for each event can be bought from We Got Tickets, with links to be found on the Manchester Comics Collective website. Also in London on Sunday the 24th of July is a fledgling new comics event in New Cross, a part of South East London that's considerably more accessible now that the East London line has been extended from Highbury and Islington down to West Croydon and Crystal Palace. The event, New Cross Turn Left, involves small press comic creators from the local area and across the country. These include David O'Connell, Ellen Lindner, Gary Northfield, Howard Hardiman, John Myers, Julia Scheel, Katie Green, Matt Sherritt, Tom Humberston, and Woodrow Phoenix. The event advertises itself as a comics and art garden party, where there'll be cake, tea, and booze, as well as live music, comic book workshops, exhibitions, and a new play featuring Derek the Sheep, performed by Gary Northfield. For more information, please go to newcrossturnleft.blogspot.com. Then, looking further ahead, on the 6th and 7th of August, there's this year's Caption Festival at the East Oxford Community Centre, where guests include Paul Grist, Paul Duffield, Kate Brown, Paul Rainey, Ian Culbard, and Jeremy Day. More information can be found at www.caption.org. Then, in an event that I've helped curate at the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth on Friday the 19th and Saturday the 20th of August, is a two-day conference and festival called Comics and Conflicts, in which various creators, critics and academics will be presenting papers and talks about war comics from various decades and various countries. Speakers include Pat Mills, Garth Ennis, Francesca Cassavetti, David Collier and Roger Sabin, and the programme is broken up into a longer academic conference on the Friday, followed by a talk by Pat Mills that evening, and then various events on the Saturday, including my Q&A with Garth Ennis on stage, artists' workshops, film screenings, and much more. You can find info and buy tickets at wartime.iwm.org.uk and at comicafestival.com. For more information about all the above, please visit my website www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where you can find extended podcasts of previous shows and links to the work of Gene Yang, my guest this week, and previous guests on the show. Panel Borders was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode this time next week. Thanks for listening.